Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. inadvertently killed hostages in a drone strike. A U.S. counterterrorism operation in January accidentally killed two hostages, one American aid worker and one Italian man, held by al-Qaeda on the Afghan-Pakistan border, the White House said. President Barack Obama personally apologized for the incident. An official statement said there was tremendous sorrow over the death of the two innocent hostages. American Warren Weinstein and Italian Giovanni Laporto, as both had been working on aid projects in Pakistan. Mr. Obama said from the White House earlier today,
"As president and as commander-in-chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations, including the one that inadvertently took the lives of Warren and Giovanni. I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the United States government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families."
Mr. Obama told reporters, based on the intelligence that we obtained at the time, including hundreds of hours of surveillance, "We believe this was an al-Qaeda compound, that no civilians were present, and that capturing these terrorists was not possible." European Union leaders are considering a plan to resolve the continent's migrant shipwreck crisis by taking military action to destroy smugglers' boats in Africa so they cannot be used to ferry refugees on a perilous journey across the Mediterranean to the southern shores of Europe. The heads of state of the 28 EU countries met in Brussels Thursday in the aftermath of last weekend's Mediterranean disaster, in which about 800 or more people drowned with only 28 rescued, when a migrant boat headed from Libya to Italy capsized. This is VOA News. Warplanes pounded Houthi rebels' targets in Yemen Thursday, 2 days after what was supposed to be the official end of the Saudi-led bombing campaign. Witnesses say the raids hit areas around the main southern port city of Aden, where fighting continues between the Houthis and supporters of the country's ousted government. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon informed the Security Council that he is nominating Mauritanian diplomat Ismail Ould Cheikh Ahmed as his new special envoy to Yemen. Cheikh Ahmed, who has been serving as UN Ebola chief, would replace Jamal Benomar, who resigned last week after losing support from Gulf countries for his mediation efforts in Yemen. The Wall Street Journal reported Wednesday top Chinese nuclear experts have expanded their estimate of North Korea's nuclear capability beyond previous U.S. estimates, making Pyongyang's arsenal a potential regional security threat. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
The Wall Street Journal says the Chinese estimate that the North may already possess 20 nuclear warheads was relayed during a closed-door meeting with U.S. nuclear specialists at the China Institute of International Studies in February. Recently, U.S. experts suggested North Korea had between 10 and 16 nuclear bombs. Troy Stangerone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute says if the journal report is true, it underscores the growing difficulty of reaching any kind of denuclearization agreement with North Korea.
It raises questions of what would North Korea do to take and give up its arsenal? How likely is it to do so?
Earlier this month, the head of U.S. Northern Command, Admiral William Gortney, warned that Pyongyang is now capable of launching a nuclear-armed missile that can reach the United States, but he said he has no indication it has been tested. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
5 months after her nomination by U.S. President Barack Obama, Loretta Lynch is expected to finally be confirmed by the Senate as the nation's next attorney general. Lynch's nomination had been held up for weeks after Senate Democrats held up passage of legislation aimed at cracking down on human trafficking due to an anti-abortion amendment inserted into the bill by Republicans. The impasse over the abortion measure was broken off earlier this week when a handful of Republicans and Democrats reached a compromise. A U.S. public opinion survey shows Republican Senator Marco Rubio leading the large group of hopefuls for the party's 2016 presidential nomination. The poll also shows Rubio doing better against likely Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton in a potential general election matchup than the other Republican presidential hopefuls. Rubio trails the former Secretary of State by 2 percentage points. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The traffickers put him on a rubber dinghy, and with this they reached the fishing boat. But he said that when they were on this boat, children were put on the first level and they were locked by keys. So when the boat capsized, the children drowned.
That's Sarah Tyler of Save the Children. She recounts the story of a Somali boy who survived a recent migrant boat tragedy on the Mediterranean. Details coming up.
Also in the news, European Union heads of state are meeting in Brussels today to discuss a range of options to halt the flow of refugees after some 900 migrants died when their ship capsized Sunday off the coast of an Italian island.
We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, European Union leaders began committing naval vessels to confront the increasing number of migrants dying in the Mediterranean this year. At an emergency session in Brussels, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the priority is to save lives. Sources say Germany has offered two troop supply ships and two frigates that are now assigned to the anti-piracy project off the coast of Somalia. Prime Minister David Cameron said Britain would contribute the Navy's flagship, HMS Bulwark, three helicopters and two Border Patrol ships to the EU effort. Belgium committed a naval ship. Prior to the meeting, EU's foreign policy chief indicated the discussion would likely focus on a military component, and the EU migration head said Europe is declaring war on smugglers. Discussion is expected to include other measures, such as funding to revive Italy's sea and rescue operation, a faster process for approving migrants' entry into Europe, and efforts in North African countries to reduce migrant flows from sub-Saharan Africa. Migrants are landing on the shores of Italy, Greece, and Malta in growing numbers as warm weather comes to the Mediterranean.
Save the Children is one of many organizations trying to help the thousands of migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Europe. Communications manager Sarah Tyler is in Catania on the eastern coast of Sicily. It's one of the ports Italian Navy vessels bring migrants after being rescued at sea. Tyler spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Well, we were here very early because we got word that another Navy ship was coming in with migrants. There were 226 migrants on this boat. Among them, there were six women. Four of them were pregnant. And we are still interviewing children who were on this boat. And at this point, we think there's 11 minors who came unaccompanied. These children came across with rubber dinghies. And one young boy from Nigeria told us that he was in a rubber dinghy, which was about 12 meters long, and water was coming in, so the dinghy was leaking. And he told us that he had to jump in the water because he was afraid that the water, you know, the boat would sink. And when he saw the rescue boat, they swam towards it. And I asked him if he had any food or water to drink on the boat. And he said he was too worried to think about surviving, to be able to think about food and water. And he said if he hadn't been rescued, they would have died.
Now, did he and the others come from Libya?
Yes, these boats came in from Libya.
Now, can you tell us the scene in Catania when the migrants arrive? What exactly happens?
The boat comes in, and they are grouped on top deck. And the women and the sick come off first, and they're visited by the Red Cross. And a lot of them don't have shoes because they've thrown the shoes off so they could swim. So they're given new shoes and socks, mostly sneakers. And then they're given a health check because some come in with some skin disease. Yesterday I was at another landing and there was a woman who came in very badly burned, so she was attended to right away. So health checks, new shoes, and immediately they're given food and water. And then Save the Children start talking to the minors about their psychosocial needs and some of the legal rights. So it's a very organized process.
Now, you had mentioned that the boy was from Nigeria. Do you know the other nationalities?
Yes, I do. Today's landing consisted of people coming from Ghana, from Guinea, from Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Guinea-Bissau, and Gambia.
Well, that's interesting because we've been getting word that many of the migrants were from the conflict areas.
What we are seeing is that children want a chance for a better life. So many are coming over, trying to risk everything to get to Europe. Some even have, you know, family members in other countries. Unfortunately, a lot of people that come here, rather than go through the legal system, they want to go to Norway, they want to go to Denmark, they want to go to Sweden. So Italy may be a transit point for a lot of people.
Now, you had mentioned that the Nigerian boy was in a rubber dinghy. Were the other migrants in those types of vessels as well?
For the landing today, yes. But we've also heard of migrants being in sort of makeshift wooden boats. And these boats really aren't meant to sail the Mediterranean. What we're seeing is, like, the smugglers, they don't care if people live or die. They just want to get them into the middle of the sea where they can be rescued.
So now that they're on dry land and Save the Children has interviewed them and given them some help, what happens next?
Well, they will now be going to reception centers. They'll be able to take a shower. Some of them haven't had showers for 8 days. Like a Syrian family were interviewed yesterday, hadn't had a shower for 8 days. Today we also saw that 4 women were pregnant. So obviously they're going to be given special attention.
And what happens after they get that attention? Are they able to go further into Europe or must they remain in some type of camp?
Well, it really depends. I mean, Save the Children will be working with them. What we advocate for is that children, they can go back to school, so children can just be children again. As you can imagine, the tales we're hearing of kids coming over from Libya are just horrific. We've heard of beatings, of torture. We've even heard that women and boys are being raped. So the stories are getting worse and worse. And I was just telling my colleague that in the 8 years I've worked at Save the Children in an emergency capacity, these are some of the worst stories I've heard.
Does Save the Children take any position on what the European Union should do to help solve this crisis?
Very much so. Save the Children is advocating that European leaders restart the search and rescue mission that ended last year, because what we have now in search and rescue is basically defense and border control. It's not meant to be a full operation. So we're calling on the European Union to restart the search and rescue mission. And today is actually make or break for this decision. And what we're seeing is that people are dying needlessly. I mean, Save the Children has predicted that up to 2,500 children could die this year alone because of the inefficient search and rescue that we have.
Can you tell me about some of the kids or a child that you've spoken to who's made this journey across the Mediterranean?
Yesterday, we spoke to Saeed, who was one of the 4 miners who survived the recent shipwreck, and he was from Somalia. He has a big family, and his parents really wanted him to go to Norway because he's got aunts and uncles there. So they actually put him in the care of Sudanese traffickers in the summer of 2014. He made the journey by himself across the desert through Sudan until he reached the Libyan border. And then he told us that he was actually held a prisoner for 9 months by armed smugglers. And this was the time it took his parents to pay for the first leg of this journey. And he said they were all badly treated. He saw children die in front of him because they didn't have enough food to eat and they became sick. When his parents finally paid the money, he went to Tripoli. He constantly had to hide because he was afraid of being put back in jail. And then finally, when he got on the boat, the traffickers put him on a rubber dinghy. And with this, they reached the fishing boat. But he said that when they were on this boat, children were put on the first level and they were locked by key. So when the boat capsized, the children drowned.
Sarah Tyler is communications manager for Save the Children from Catania, Sicily. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. In related news, a Libyan Coast Guard officer says there's little that can be done to stop smugglers' boats carrying migrants to Europe. He told AP that the smugglers are working with militias who are heavily armed. AP says the traffickers make large sums of money and even advertise their services on Facebook.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Chad military forces are preparing to push into Nigeria's Sambisa forest from the Cameroon border. This as Nigerian warplanes begin a bombing assault on Boko Haram forces hiding in the vast woods. Armed forces from Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and Nigeria hope to close in on the Islamist insurrection soon. But bad weather and low visibility have slowed Nigeria's initial bombing campaign. Nigeria sources say U.S. drones have not been able to locate militant camps in the forest. The Siambisa is a large forest and former wildlife reserve where Boko Haram forces established military camps over the years. The insurgents are believed to be hiding in the Siambisa some of the more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls they kidnapped over a year ago. President-elect Muhammadu Buhari pledged to search for the girls, but says he is not certain what has happened to them. Boko Haram once occupied major portions of three states in northern Nigeria, killing thousands of civilians and displacing more than 1.5 million. Military forces of four regional powers began a sweep of the region 3 months ago.
A court in Guinea has sentenced 11 people to life in prison for the murders of 8 Ebola awareness workers. The butchered bodies of 2 medical officers, a pastor, 2 local officials, and 3 journalists were found in a public latrine in the remote village of Wome 7 months ago. Wome is more than 600 miles south of the capital, Conakry. The team was attacked and killed by a mob throwing stones. The prosecutor had requested the death sentence for 26 members of the mob. 15 were found innocent of the charges and released. In related news, the World Health Organization today released new figures for the Ebola epidemic. It says the number of cases in the more than year-long outbreak has topped 26,000 and there have been over 10,800 deaths. Meanwhile, the journal Science reports the first successful experiments with anti-Ebola drugs on 3 monkeys. The experimental drug known as TKM Ebola Guinea cured the monkeys infected with the virus. Unlike other anti-Ebola drugs recently tested on monkeys, the Tecamira pharmaceutical product was proven effective on the Ebola strain that swept through West Africa over the past year. However, scientists warn that the drug has not yet been proven effective on humans.
Facing an outbreak of meningitis, the government of Niger has begun a vaccination program and closed all schools in the capital and in a western district. An estimated 85 people have died of the disease this year. Prime Minister Brigi Farfini has announced the government has more than 1 million doses of the vaccine to be given to children between the ages of 2 and 15. Schools are scheduled to reopen on Monday. Meningococcal meningitis infects the thin lining surrounding the brain and spinal cord. It can cause severe brain damage, deafness, epilepsy, or necrosis. If untreated, meningitis is fatal in 50% of cases. Also in Niger, the World Health Organization has announced the nation is also experiencing an outbreak of H5N1 bird flu at a chicken farm in Maradi, a town near the Nigerian border. Most of the more than 2,500 chickens have died. H5N1 usually does not spread to humans.
Also, the World Health Organization reports dramatic progress has been made in the fight against malaria, but more needs to be done. In advance of World Malaria Day, April 25th, the UN agency is calling for global action to close gaps that remain in the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of the malaria. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says phenomenal progress has been made in the fight against malaria in the past 15 years. Richard Cebulski is coordinator for strategy, economics, and elimination in the WHO Global Malaria Program. He says a tenfold increase in funding for malaria since the year 2000 has resulted in huge expansion of malaria programs. He says more people than ever before have access to insecticide-treated mosquito nets, and more people are getting diagnostic tests and appropriate treatment.
As a result, the incidence of malaria declined by 30% globally, and mortality rates by 40% globally between 2000 and 2013. Of the 106 countries with malaria transmission in the year 2000, 13 have reduced the number of locally acquired cases to zero, and four countries are now reporting less than 10 locally acquired cases per year.
But the WHO estimates there were nearly 200 million cases of malaria worldwide in 2013 and more than 500,000 deaths. It says 90% of all malaria deaths occur in Africa, most among children under five. One reason the mortality rate among children is so high is that millions of pregnant women do not receive effective preventive drugs. As a result of malaria infection during pregnancy, WHO estimates 10,000 women and between 75,000 and 200,000 infants die annually from this preventable disease. WHO Global Malaria Program Medical Officer Peter Olumese tells VOA, many children do not receive the right dose of medication.
Most times when the pharmaceuticals companies develop drugs, most of the studies are done in the adult population. Dosages are determined in the adult population. And thereafter, we extrapolate the pediatric dose in a way treating children as small adults. And it doesn't necessarily work out that way.
The WHO says tools available for fighting malaria are inexpensive and highly effective, and preventive treatments could save tens of thousands of lives every year. But coverage needs to be significantly scaled up. This challenge is the focus of a new WHO Global Malaria Strategy, which aims to reduce the disease by at least 90% by 2030. The UN Health Agency figures the cost of achieving this goal will rise from $5 billion to $9 billion a year, mainly due to population growth. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiyas Wuhib, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. European Union heads of state are meeting in Brussels today to discuss a range of options to halt the flow of refugees after some 900 migrants died when their ship capsized Sunday off the coast of an Italian island. And a court in Guinea has sentenced 11 people accused of killing a team of 8 Ebola workers to life in prison. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Over 50 female leaders from around the world recently published a declaration calling for the end of poor sanitation and hygiene in the developing world. Among those leaders are the First Ladies of Madagascar and Malawi, who announced the declaration in Washington, D.C. The UN's Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council, WSSCC, paved the way for the declaration. It says 2.5 billion people currently live without access to improved sanitation. In Africa, 340 million people still lack clean drinking water, and 547 million lack access to basic sanitation. Chris Williams is executive director of the WSSCC. He spoke with me about the declaration and what the council is doing to help provide safe water and sanitation services to African countries.
The declaration on water and sanitation by women leaders is an initiative of a number of different organizations and governments that are trying to put focus on a challenge that the world has due to the lack of water and sanitation. Particularly sanitation and hygiene. It's a major challenge. It's one of the least met MDGs, or Millennium Development Goals. So this was spearheaded by the Global Poverty Project, which is an initiative that tries to promote awareness and do advocacy work with concrete results. And they gathered a number of organizations, the Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council, the World Bank, UNICEF, And they organized with a number of state finance ministers and first ladies to try to political support behind this initiative.
How involved are the first ladies of Madagascar and Malawi in ending poor sanitation in their countries?
The first lady of Malawi has launched an initiative called Beautify Malawi, which brings together women's empowerment, particularly adolescent girls, waste management, education, and sanitation and hygiene. It's a creative initiative that she has launched throughout Malawi, which builds upon a number of ongoing activities and introduces some new things. So what she's doing with this global declaration is just bringing to a global level what she's doing at the national level, which is really what we had in mind with this whole initiative, because we don't want people to necessarily start with some global initiative and then try to impose it on countries. We're trying to create a global platform where we can draw upon creative initiatives that are happening by women leaders around the world. In Madagascar, the president and the first lady have launched what's called a Year of Sanitation, which is 2015, which focuses on ending the practice of open defecation, which is the lack of any use of toilet facilities, which has enormous public health risks. The ending of the practice of open defecation by the year 2019. So the two first ladies attended this event last night, organized by the Global Poverty Project, to pledge their commitment to this declaration and to officially launch the declaration.
Why is hygiene such a big challenge in developing countries?
I think the challenge is that it's shifted from an infrastructure issue to a behavior issue. So infrastructure traditionally was how people solved problems of water and sanitation, tried to build facilities, provide subsidies, undertake contracting procedures to go into rural villages and peri-urban areas and create sanitation facilities for people. This has proved over the last 10 years to be very ineffective because the purpose for the use of sanitation facilities, the maintenance of them, the good hygiene practices associated with them were not associated with the infrastructure. So there's been a change from a technical infrastructure approach to one in which community sensitization of the linkages between sanitation and health, hygiene and human dignity, and an approach towards bringing about behavior change has been adopted. And over 30 countries in the world have signed up to this approach. One of the terms that is used in methodologies is community-led total sanitation, CLTS. And this is an approach where village by village an entire country can be transformed to bring about positive changes in hygiene behavior, which then ensures greater toilet use as well as maintenance.
Earlier, you talked about one of the countries working on eradicating open defecation, which has been a really big problem.
Yeah.
And you all have actually, for almost 7 million people, were able to eradicate this. What countries did this occur in where it's been eradicated?
The countries in which we've been working are Madagascar, Uganda, Tanzania, Kenya, Ethiopia, Malawi, Togo, Benin, Nigeria and Senegal in Africa. And in these countries, we have worked with non-governmental organizations, government, and other international organizations to design national sanitation and hygiene improvement programs, which, as I said before, work village by village, district by district to cover large tracts of the country to make them open defecation free. This is a process that is still ongoing. We believe that Madagascar and Malawi will be the first for the entire country to be open defecation free.
That was Chris Williams, Executive Director of the UN's Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council. He spoke with me from Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing music in Africa. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. European Union heads of state are meeting in Brussels today to discuss a range of options to halt the flow of refugees after some 900 migrants died when their ship capsized Sunday off the coast of an Italian island. And according, Guinea sentences 11 people accused of killing a team of 8 Ebola workers to life in prison. Coming up, we have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, investors say Nigeria's economic picture is fairly promising. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhi Bands. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we'll start off with boxing.
Okay.
Yes, and tickets for next week's fight between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao finally go on sale on Thursday. With 9 days to the fight, the sale of tickets had become a key issue. The May 2nd welterweight bout at the MGM Grand, which is expected to be the largest grossing fight in history, is now officially on. There had been disputes over allocation of tickets, credentials and hotel rooms, among other things, and despite the fact that the fighters had signed to face each other in February, there hadn't been a contract between the promoters and the MGM. Tickets for the fight are priced at $10,000, $7,500, $5,000, $3,500, $2,500, and $1,500. However, none of the $10,000 seats will be available for public purchase. There will be between 35,000 and 50,000 closed circuit seats available in Las Vegas, with a figure closer to the higher end. However, the sale of tickets to live event will be extremely small and likely are only to be around 500. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Mark begins with a volleyball.
Kenya outplayed Ethiopia 25-19, 25-17 and 25-9 in the Zone 5 Women's All-Africa Games volleyball qualifiers in Kampala, Uganda on Wednesday night. Egypt dismissed hosts Uganda in similar straight sets. Earlier on Tuesday, Kenya beat Egypt by 3-1, while Uganda outclassed Burundi in 3 straight sets. Today, Thursday, Uganda play Ethiopia, while Burundi challenge Egypt. Turning to athletics, Ivory Coast's Marie Jose Talou clocked 11.28 seconds and 23.77 seconds to prevail in women's 100 meters and 200 meters respectively at the Confederation of African Athletics meet in Bamako, Mali on Tuesday night. Toumani Koulibaly won men's 400 meters in 46.13 seconds, while Senegal's Fatoumata Diop prevailed in the women's 400 meters. In Mauritius, the second edition of the Africa Youth Athletics Championship gets underway in Redouit today, Thursday. Defending champions Nigeria are among 28 nations whose athletes are vying for medals at the four-day event. Meanwhile, Africa 400-meter championship silver medalist Wade van Niekerk aims high at the University Sports South Africa Athletics Championships in Stellenbosch, South Africa. The two-day event starts tomorrow, Friday.
I'll be doubling up on the 2 and 4. My goals are to something similar to last year.
That's where you did the 20.21. I know you like the 200 more than the 400 meters. Thinking about your 200 meters, is that where you plan to perhaps even improve on that time?
Well, as everyone knows, that's where the love began for athletics, was in the 200 meters, the sprint event. So that's where I started with my career. So it's like your first love. You didn't really lose that chemistry that you had with it. So to me, I would like to improve my time every single time I race the race, and I'd like to do better than what I did previously.
Only two Africans have ever run sub-20. That's Francis Obikwelu and Frank Fredericks. At some point in your career, do you see a sub-20 possible?
To be honest with you, seeing that you've brought out the statistics at this moment, I believe in South Africa there's quite a few guys that would get that right now in the shape and the talent that's come out in South Africa at this moment. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few guys that would break that 22nd barrier this year, and I'd like to be one of them.
That was South Africa's Wade van Niekerk, the Africa Championship 400-meter silver medalist, speaking in Stellenbosch, Western Cape Province, South Africa.
Mark Homer, thanks, Mark. Now, still in South Africa, most rugby teams are still overwhelmingly composed of white players. Some argue affirmative action is needed to push change and have teams more racially mixed. Emily Yob reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
Rugby in South Africa is more than just a national sport. It is one which carries a lot of symbolism here. Back in 1995, the image of the country's newly elected first black president, Nelson Mandela, sporting a jersey from the national rugby team, the Springboks, and handing the Rugby World Cup to the blonde Afrikaner Springbok captain, François Pienaar, remains to this day one of the most iconic sports moments in history. Under apartheid, rugby was considered the sport of the white elite, and it was hated by the black majority. But to Mr. Mandela, rugby presented an opportunity to forge a new path toward racial unity and help all South Africans start to reconcile. More than 20 years later, though, the number of black players in big rugby clubs remains very small. Akona Ndogane, who trains with the Pretoria Blue Bulls, is one of the few of his generation to have reached the top level.
The determination that I had at the time, you know, to work hard and to make sure that I'm not just there because of colour. I have to prove to myself and to the coaching staff that, you know, I deserve to be there.
Rugby isn't a sport for just white people anymore, and a lot of players across the country are black. So the motivation is there, but with limited funds, developing a quality game has proven tough. Craig Asiabonga is a volunteer rugby coach in the township of Alexandra in Johannesburg.
We have nothing, man. That's all I can say. We have few balls, few cones. We don't even have a scrum machine. So how can you coach kids to scrum if you don't even have a scrum machine?
Most players are selected by big clubs early on, during talent scouting at inter-school competitions, says Kevin de Klerk, president of the Golden Lion Rugby Union.
We then send some scouts to come and have a look and see what the talent is like. Then we will promote them to academies and then to senior school sides and the provincial sides later on.
But among these private school teams, black players are also very few. To tackle that problem, the South African Rugby Union recently announced its intention to impose controversial quotas. Some, like sport journalist Simnikiwe Xabanesa, think this is not the real solution.
This is not a numbers situation. This is about changing people's mentalities. Government should be involved at grassroots level. You know, you need to put facilities at schools. You know, they've got to grow up with rugby poles in their schools that they come from the townships, as opposed to having to go to a so-called white school.
The goal is to have 50% of black players in all the provincial teams by 2019. Emily Yab in Johannesburg for VOA News.
Thanks, Emily. Still in athletics, the London Marathon, also known as the Virgin Money London Marathon, takes place this Sunday. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with defending champion Kenyan Edna Kiplagat. Here is Andy.
We're talking with Edna Kiplagat of Kenya, who is the defending champion in the London Marathon on Sunday. Also, she is the double world champion, so might slip in a question or two about whether she's going to be defending her title in Beijing this summer. First of all, Edna, does having that London title in your grasp, does that give you a psychological extra edge over your other rivals, who are, of course, very good as well?
Yeah, I know the ladies who are running together on Sunday, they are very strong, and they have done very well in their competitions. But for me, as a defending champion, I will try my best. I believe in myself, and I know that the training that I have done is a good one, so I hope that I'm going to do well on Sunday.
Is this as good a women's marathon field as you've ever faced, perhaps outside a major championship?
Yeah, I can say this is the best field that they have selected this year. Mary has won this race twice. Friska has won. Florence was second last year, and I know she's looking forward to win. So this is the best field ever selected to run on Sunday. But I believe if everything goes well, I will try to go for the win.
Of course, to reach the level that you have done in athletics, you have to train hard and rest. But you have also have another life. You have children. I mean, five children in total. And, well, you can tell me more about, we always hear about the farm and the chickens that you have back home in Kenya. How much time does that take up? I mean, first of all, the children.
Yeah, I know being a mother as well as being an athlete, it's not easy. But what I'm happy about is my husband is a good supporter. He's doing very well. He plans everything for us. He plans when it's time for training, we change, we go for training. But when it's time for the family, he makes sure that he organizes everything. We also have a babysitter who is taking care of our children. And so it's easier. I know part of it is the farm, but my husband has taken most of the responsibilities. He has a farm manager who is taking care of everything in the farm. So it's easier for us. After training, I get time to rest while he goes out there and look for the what is going on in the farm.
Well, it sounds like a very organized lifestyle. What about later on this year? You're the only woman to have won two world titles in the marathon. Are you going to be going to Beijing and hoping to make it a third?
I'm focusing for this race on Sunday, and then afterwards, then we'll go back home, and then we can see what we'll do after this.
Well, back home, of course, you hope with another London Marathon title and, well, chance to catch up with the kids, the farm, and all sorts of things in life. Edna Kiplagat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. That was the energetic Andy Edwards in London. Meanwhile, athletics governing body has asked sports highest court to double Rita Jepto's two-year doping ban. But the Kenyan athlete has filed an appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, seeking to overturn her punishment for failing a drug test. Jepto, who is 34, became Kenya's first high-profile athlete to be failed a test when she tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs in September. Athletics Kenya has suspended her from all competition until October 2016. Meanwhile, the Court of Arbitration of Sport has said International Association of Athletics Federation wants a four-year ban because of aggravating circumstances. But Jepto, who says she may have been prescribed some banned substances at a local hospital after a road accident, is seeking a delay in the ban's implementation and hopes to compete in August World Championships. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Simpoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Douglas will have an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, treating individuals for psychiatric problems in South Sudan. And next, investors say Nigeria's economic picture is fairly promising. But first, some music. Here is Alonzo of Sierra Leone with Angel.
She used to love me and I used to love her cause she's my first love. And when she's always by my side, I've never ever made me cry. Now in all the girl, it made me smile. The kind of girl of my dreams. And then we promised to be together forever and ever. But one day, it come away with a funny look on her face. Because she came to say goodbye. Cause tomorrow she'll be traveling. He said, it is going to London. And she told me to be strong.
stronger. He promised me, say he go call her. It's been 6 years and since she left, but still I haven't heard her voice. Place. I just didn't think about her pretty face and all the things that we used to do, including how I used to kiss her pretty lips. But right now I am so lonely, and it don't take, she still never called me. I don't know why, how to let her go, but this is the time that I need her most. I can't sleep without me, angel. I can't stop missing me, and I can't go on without me, angel. Look for me, angel. Tell me, Papa, yeah. Tell him, say I don't go. I don't go, London, no. To look for me, angel. Please tell DJ Boxy, yeah. Tell him, say I don't go.
I don't go.
Alonzo of Sierra Leone with Angel.
Well, Juba Teaching Hospital says it gets at least 20 patients a day who are seeking treatment for psychiatric problems. The head of the hospital's psychiatric department says some of the patients are rounded up by health workers and police officers and brought to the hospital for treatment. Jacob Achik has the story for VOA from Juba.
Atong Ayuelongar is the head of the psychiatric department and the director of mental health at Juba Teaching Hospital. He said poverty, social and financial problems are common in the patient seeking help.
As any mental ill cases all over the world, we talk about the so-called genetic causes. Those who are having mental illness within their family, they are prone to have mental illnesses. The other thing is with the so-called environmental factors. Mainly, we are talking here about trauma and substance of abuse, alcohol and cannabis, mainly. They are the main causes of presentation here. Plus the trauma of a long-lasting war, plus the crisis of 2013.
Ayel says on normal days, the hospital get around 10 to 15 patients seeking psychiatric help, but she says the number has increased because...
We are now having the campaign for the homeless mental health cases, which are moving naked around the cities in the whole country. We start doing this project for Juba City because we are here around. So we go out with the police officer to collect cases in a 3 days duration. We give them medication and we give them clothes and we give them small food items.
The number of homeless people in Juba has increased since South Sudan plunged into conflict in December 2013. Many people flee to Juba, which is safe compared to other parts of country where fighting is still ongoing. But once they arrive, they had nowhere to live. Ayuel says that project to help the homeless will run until July of this year.
Last month, we collect like 38 patients in 2 days, because in the third day we didn't work last month because, you know, of logistic things. So in 2 days we collect like 38 patients. They were all naked. They were all, you know, dirty. But in the second campaign we see this month, this is now the third day. In the previous 2 days, we collect like 20 cases.
Ayuel says many of the psychiatric patients that are picked up and brought to the hospital are not able to speak. He said that might be artificially keeping down the number of patients who seek help at the hospital. He says most people with mental problems are given a once-a-month supply of medicine. Many of the patients who are placed on medicine have improved. He says, but the hospital faces another issue as it deals with the psychologically traumatized population in Juba.
Actually, I don't have places to keep them. That's why in my campaign, I go out, I collect them, I give them the so-called long-acting antipsychotic. It's a medicine that stays in their body for 1 month. We give them medication and we advise the family to bring them to a follow-up on a regular basis.
Bashir Emmanuel, 27, is one of the patients who had received help at Juba Hospital. He has separated from mental illness for 2 years.
Bashir Emmanuel, disabled 27.
Emmanuel says when he arrived at the hospital, he was told he had to remain there so that he could be given medication. He said when he was discharged last month, he was taken to Gudele. He stayed there ever since. Ayuel said it is very difficult to treat some patients because many does not have a clear diagnosis. He said the mental health department is working to raise community awareness so that relatives of the patient are able to spot the symptom of mental health issues and bring people into hospital quickly for diagnosis and treatment. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
Investors focused on Africa say Nigeria offers huge business opportunities but also huge challenges. The continent's most populous nation has been dogged by a deadly insurgency, contentious elections, and low oil prices. Yet some investors say the Nigeria's economic picture is fairly promising. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Africa's most populous nation has its fair share of issues. The army is battling a Boko Haram insurgency that has rendered parts of its northeast a no-go zone. The nation will hold hotly contested elections at the end of the month, which were delayed 6 weeks due to security concerns. And the economy is still largely dependent on a volatile resource, oil. But even that grim picture cannot compete with the sheer numbers. Nigeria's population is estimated at 170 million people. Its middle class is growing rapidly, and a recent reevaluation of the nation's economy vaulted it above South Africa. In a more meaningful indicator, the World Bank says Nigeria's per capita GDP is steadily rising to its current level of about $3,000. Investment analyst Martin Davis, the CEO of Frontier Advisory, says that makes the West African nation a no-brainer for some investors, particularly those looking at the nation's burgeoning consumer base.
There's been an incredible interest, particularly multinational South African capital going to Nigeria, and largely into the FMCG, fast-moving consumer goods sector. So particularly for consumer-facing enterprises, Nigeria's been almost a no-brainer. 170-odd million people, one in five Africans almost, is Nigerian.
Despite the attractive numbers, doing business in Nigeria is tough for even savvy companies. Upmarket South African retailer Woolworths pulled out of Nigeria in 2013, after just 2 years, citing high rents and flagging sales. Sub-Saharan Africa Managing Director for ratings agency Standard & Poor's, Conrad Royce, says Nigeria still has a double B-minus rating, putting it below the threshold to be considered an investment destination. Royce says the headlines do affect the rating, and the agency is holding its breath as elections approach.
I have to highlight that we have the rating on watch negative at the moment because of a number of things that are obviously happening in Nigeria.
But Royce says Nigeria also shows promise.
It's a diverse, vibrant economy with very strong, very impressive entrepreneurs in Nigeria.
It is an exciting prospect, investors say, much like this exciting, ever-changing nation. But success in Nigeria may require a virtue that today's fast-moving market is not known for: patience. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State in early March recognized 10 women from around the globe with the Secretary of State's International Women of Courage Award. They were honored for their outstanding contributions to peace, human rights, gender equality, and social progress. If we are to address and meet our most pressing global challenges, we must include women and girls, Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources Heather Higginbottom said during the ceremony. But too often, women have no voice in the political process or access to the halls of justice. Still, the voices of many are difficult to ignore. To amplify women's voices, three of the awardees formed advocacy groups. Maysaba Pugh is the director of the Gender Equality Network in Burma, a coalition of some 90 organizations collaborating to advocate for women's rights. She has been instrumental in developing Burma's inaugural National Strategic Plan for the Advancement of Women. After an outbreak of violence in Burma's Kachin State in 2011, Ms. May co-founded the Kachin Peace Network and the Kachin Women's Peace Network to raise awareness of internally displaced persons, of specific needs of displaced women, and to advocate for peace and reconciliation in Burma. Sayaka Osakabe sparked a nationwide conversation about discrimination against women in the Japanese workforce through an organization she founded, Matahara Net. One of the women she helped won a landmark Japan Supreme Court case in October 2014, ruling against pregnancy discrimination. Ms. Osakabe has advocated strongly, and the government of Japan has taken commendable policy steps to address the issue. Rosa Julieta Montaño Salvatierra of Bolivia has spent much of her life working towards protecting women's rights and to protect women from sexual exploitation and violence. 30 years ago, she founded the NGO Oficina Jurídica para la Mujer, or Legal Office for Women, which promotes gender equality through education and by influencing public policy. The organization has worked with the Bolivian legislature in drafting laws that help or protect women, such as stricter penalties for rape, greater protection for reproductive rights, and advanced gender equality laws. These honorees demonstrate to us what is possible when women stand up for their rights and freedoms, said Deputy Secretary Higginbottom. But they also demonstrate that we have a long road still to travel to achieve justice and equality for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing music in Africa. This light hearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.